Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Donald Trump takes on the press, fake news, the leaks, and whether or not he has connections to Russia.
I own nothing in Russia. I have no loans in Russia. I don't have any deals in Russia.
We'll get the latest on Trump versus the press. Also today, a local police chief pushes back against the president's executive order to defund sanctuary cities.
There's going to be a real problem with trust. There's going to be a real problem with the spirit of cooperation that we currently enjoy.
Plus, what our modern politics are doing to language.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that.
In the age of alternative facts, how the Springfield-based Merriam-Webster Dictionary is keeping up with the meaning of words. All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin today, as we have been all week, because it's virtually impossible to ignore the news from Washington and President Donald Trump. He held an extraordinary no-holds news conference today that concluded less than an hour ago. He attacked the Democrats for leaving him a mess, the press for peddling fake news, and said his administration is running like a fine-tuned machine. And he addressed questions following the firing of his national security advisor, General Michael Flynn, for failing to describe accurately his contact with Russian officials at the end of last year. Trump flatly denied that he or anyone in his administration colluded with the Russians before he entered the White House.
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question, so important. Russia is a ruse. I have nothing to do with Russia. Haven't made a phone call to Russia in years. Don't speak to people from Russia. Not that I wouldn't. I just have nobody to speak to.
Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe. Matt, always a pleasure to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Anthony.
I know you followed the press conference, which ran for an impressive hour and 15 minutes. Before we talk about some of the specifics, how do you sum up what just happened? Because it was sort of an extraordinary confrontation between Trump and the press, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to sum it up in one way. It was, you know, sort of back to campaign mode for Trump. You know, he talked a lot about Hillary Clinton. He was combative. He seemed to be enjoying himself a little bit from the podium and sort of the sparring that comes with the media that he's kind of avoided doing some of that since being inaugurated just 4 weeks ago. So I mean, it was a combative session and sort of sprawling.
Yeah,
it was sort of all over the place.
Well, I agree with you. He did seem to be enjoying it. Let's talk about some of the specifics and I guess sort of the news that he made. He was asked a number of times about what he knew, what members of his administration or campaign might have known about Lieutenant General Michael Flynn's contacts with the Russian ambassador last December. Did we get a clear answer on that question that has dominated so much of Washington politics these days?
He did talk about Flynn, and it did seem to be as Sean Spicer, his press secretary, was saying a few days ago, where the president did not have any issues with Mike Flynn being in contact with the Russian ambassador, potentially even over talking about sanctions before President Trump took office. But he did have problems with Mike Flynn sort of lying about those conversations or misremembering them, and that he had sort of just lost trust in his national security advisor. So he did elaborate on that a little bit more than he has over the past couple of days.
Yeah. And he also was asked a number of times, right? Reporters kept coming back to this question about, did members of his campaign, were they aware of Flynn's conversations? Was the president aware of Flynn's conversations with the Russian ambassador? And he seemed to answer that pretty emphatically, no. At one point he said, I own nothing in Russia. I have no loans in Russia. I don't have any deals in Russia. What was left unanswered about this issue, in your view, Matt?
Well, yeah, there were, you know, aside from the conversation about Flynn, there was repeated questions about contacts that Donald Trump's campaign had. This is his, you know, his campaign manager at the time, Paul Manafort. Some of it is Mike Flynn. There were others in his campaign. What contacts did they have with Russians during the campaign? And he, for the first several times, he avoided the question almost altogether. You know, he kept talking about his business side. He didn't have any business deals. He didn't have loans in Russia. You know, sort of taking the question in a different direction than any collaboration during the campaign. Eventually, he did say, not that he doesn't know of any contact. Julie Pace from the Associated Press pressed him on that several times, and finally he did seem to give an answer. But it took a long time, which is sort of odd. If he doesn't have anything to hide, if it's a definitive no, you would think that he would come out and say that from the very beginning, and he did not. It took him a while, and his answer was nobody that I know of in terms of if his campaign had contact with Russia.
Matt, the president also talked about the news leaks, which have given rise to so much reporting this week, and this has been a big focus of the president. He calls these leaks criminal. Let's listen to a bit of what he said at a certain point this afternoon.
Well, the leaks are real. You're the one that wrote about them and reported them. I mean, the leaks are real. You know what they said. You saw it. And the leaks are absolutely real. The news is fake because so much of the news is fake.
So the leaks are real. The news is fake. Matt Pfizer, do you care to parse that statement? What does that mean?
A little bit of cognitive kind of dissonance there with him claiming the things that you read about involving the leaks are real news, but the rest of it is fake. You know, so this is, you know, President Trump. I mean, the odd thing about it is he criticizes the media so much, but it's so clear from moments like that hour and 15 minutes just how much of a news consumer he is. I mean, he was criticizing people's individual shows and networks and what he's reading in the Washington Post and the New York Times. He criticized a story in the Wall Street Journal today. You know, he is consuming all of this news so much, and this seemed to be, this whole press conference in some ways seemed to be a response from the coverage that he did not like and he did not appreciate. And so he wanted to sort of have a press conference and talk about things on his own terms.
And on that very subject, I want to play another clip from the press conference just a few moments ago, talking about what he sees about the way his administration is covered versus what he regards as the truth. Here's what he said.
I turn on the TV, open the newspapers, and I see stories of chaos. Yet it is the exact opposite. This administration is running like a fine-tuned machine, despite the fact that I can't get my cabinet approved.
So, Matt, that speaks exactly to the point you were making. I mean, the fact that he is a news consumer, and it was there to kind of counter, to offer a counter-narrative, I guess, to what we've been reading, right?
Yeah, I mean, he talked about, you know, how everything is running quite well. You know, this sort of runs counter. I mean, Mike Flynn has resigned earlier than any national security advisor in history since that position was created in the 1950s. He had a cabinet secretary yesterday withdraw, the 12th such kind of cabinet secretary to withdraw in history. He talked about how his travel ban, the rollout, was perfect. When all evidence is otherwise, I mean, that's under, you know, the courts have stopped that. You know, so, I mean, I think that this was an effort to attempt to get back on offense and sort of tout the things that President Trump feels like are successes that are not given the attention that they deserve. He was reading through a litany of things at the start of the press conference to tout the things that he thinks he's done so far. But Congress is up in arms. Republican members of Congress are upset over the rollout of the travel ban, for example, the lack of specifics on several of the policies. So this is not just a battle between the news media and President Trump. There's some members of Congress in the court system that are also sort of at odds with the president.
Interesting days in Washington. Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, helping us understand them. Thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And on to another contested topic under the Trump administration, the executive order on immigration signed last month. Among other things, the order calls for withholding federal funds from so-called sanctuary cities. Now, the definition varies, but generally, these are places where immigrants are not asked about their legal status and where local officials do not prosecute immigrants based solely on their immigration status. Last week, the cities of Chelsea and Lawrence filed suit, arguing that the executive order violates the separation of powers because it seeks to, quote, commandeer local officials to enforce the federal government's immigration policies. To get a perspective from a local police chief, we're joined by Brian Kies, the chief of police in Chelsea. He's also president of the Massachusetts Major City Chiefs of Police Association. And Chief Kies, thanks for coming in. It's good to meet you.
Thanks for inviting me. A pleasure to meet you as well.
So what is your biggest concern about the president's executive order?
Honestly, the concern at a local level, like working in a diverse city like Chelsea, is trust. I mean, that's the first word that comes to mind, trust. And we don't want to, from a local police perspective, do anything that violates that trust with the residents that we have. I'm in my 10th year now as the police chief. I've been with the department for 30 years. We have a very diverse community in Chelsea. Probably half the city, if not more, is foreign-born. There's some statistics that say 62% of the city is Latino. Arguably, it's a lot higher than that, some of which may be undocumented. These individuals can be targeted for committing crimes, and we want these people to trust the police to report crimes. If they're in fear that we're going to enforce locally civil federal immigration law, we won't have that trust.
So what is the policy in the police department right now regarding immigrants who are in the country illegally and who might come into contact with your officers? What's the policy? How are they treated? Vis-a-vis their immigration status.
Sure. Absolutely. Number one, obviously, they're treated with respect and dignity, all people, including immigrants. They're treated like anybody else if they are, in fact, committing a crime. They're subjected to booking where we take their fingerprints and their photographs. Their fingerprints will go to the state police instantaneously, electronically, their biometric fingerprints, and then in turn will go to the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. ICE has a database, and if any individual is on that database that they have an actionable interest in that person, they make a decision whether or not to send a detainer, a document that's good for 48 hours. And we honor all detainers. We haven't had many. They first went into effect here.
So that's in order to detain them for ICE.
Detain them for ICE for up to 48 hours.
Yeah.
So that ICE, the way that the policy, there's two different policies, federal policies that have came out over the course of the last 5 years. One of them was the policy known as the Secure Communities Program, which was in effect from May of 2012 until January 1st of 2015. And then there was the Priority Enforcement Program, which was in effect until January 25th of this year. But we've only had 46 detainers. Out of 7,000 arrests in that time period, we've honored all 46. An ICE agent in all situations has never come down to the station to interview the person. The person was held overnight or sent to court that day if court was open and went to court the next day. That's really the process.
So in Chelsea, as a sanctuary city, what does the police department not do that it would be required to do if it decided that it was no longer going to be a sanctuary city?
Great question. Well, first off, the definition of sanctuary city or sanctuary jurisdiction is different all over the country.
Right.
I can only speak to what it means in Chelsea. In Chelsea, essentially, it's a page and a half document, which the only sentence that really specifically pertains to the police that says the local police shall not engage in raids that are not directly related to public safety, period. So if ICE comes in the city, ICE has two branches. One of them is Homeland Security Investigations. They investigate crimes like the ATF, the FBI, the DEA. We work with them all the time. There's another branch known as the Enforcement and Removal Operations Branch. They're more of a civil component. people that have final orders of deportations, perhaps, they'll notify us they're coming to the city. They're going to a designated address looking for an individual. But because they're enforcing federal civil immigration law, we don't respond with them for the simple reason we can't. We can't enforce federal civil immigration law. Certainly, if they needed help, if there was an officer safety issue, we'd be there instantaneously. But again, we don't participate in those investigations. We don't participate in any raids. I mean, thankfully, since I've been the chief, there have been no raids. I think there's been roundups at times where there's been a list of 3, 4, 5 people they were looking for. Our policy states if they have a criminal warrant in effect for them, we will be there because we have a state interest.
Right.
If it's strictly civil, we will not because we don't have the legal authority to enforce federal civil immigration law.
Right. And this gets also back to your concern that you spoke of a few minutes ago. You don't want to necessarily be associated with these federal raids for fear of what it would do to the relationship between your officers and the folks in Chelsea, right?
Correct. I mean, we have community meetings, a couple times a week. We sit with residents. Our goal is to work together to partner with all of our residents to address recurring problems in the city. And for a local police officer, be it myself, a ranking officer, or a patrol officer, to sit down in a community room setting, talking about partnering to address certain community issues, and then later on that night, working with an agency, albeit ICE, on the civil side, to enforce civil immigration law. Honestly, I'd be talking out of both sides of my mouth. Mm-hmm. We're talking about trust and partnerships, and then I'm going above and beyond my legal authority to put my hands on somebody, to hold somebody where I have no right to do so.
One of the basic issues that animates many people who supported Donald Trump, as you know, is this idea that our borders are too porous and too many people come into the United States in violation of the law. What's your response to that? And does it undermine the rule of law for officers of the law to sort of look the other way if there is a suspicion that they're violating federal law?
I mean, it's a tough question. I mean, obviously, we're up in the area of Boston, Massachusetts. We're not near the border.
Yeah.
People that ultimately come to our community, they may look a certain way. They may look like they were born in another country. But how do we, as local police, if we had that authority, pick and choose who we think is here legally versus illegally based on their accent, based on, you know, the way they talk, the way they look? I think there's a slippery slope there, something that, you know, from a local police perspective, I would never want to go down.
I'm curious what you can tell me about local funding. The president's executive order calls for withholding federal funds from sanctuary cities. Do you know how much funding is at stake in a city like Chelsea? And what does that funding go toward?
Sure. There's approximately $14 million in federal funding out of a $170 million budget in Chelsea, which is about 8% of our budget. So it's significant, certainly. A lot of it goes to the schools. A lot of it goes to health and human services programs. And a lot of it goes to, or some of it goes to the police department for different funding initiatives, be it what's called COPS grants, where we actually have hired, I think, 9 police officers over the past 6 years from federal funds, a split with federal and local money. It's very helpful. It's money that we count on, money that we need. So
losing this money could actually make Chelsea less secure. It would affect policing in Chelsea, it sounds.
That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah. If this executive order were imposed, how would it change policing in the city?
That's interesting. I mean, well, the one provision in the executive order that really, aside from what we're talking about with this particular lawsuit, the one provision that really causes me pause is the suggestion that the local police or local police should be involved in what's known as a 287G agreement, an agreement with the federal government where local police would be sworn to enforce federal civil immigration law. And again, getting back to what I said at the beginning, if local police in Chelsea, Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, any department across the state, not to mention across the country, if they're enforcing federal civil immigration law, and we have significant number of people here that, you know, were born in other countries, now they're resident aliens, now they're citizens, not to mention the undocumented population, there's going to be a real problem with trust. There's going to be a real problem with the spirit of cooperation that we currently enjoy. And it's going to be a real, you know, in terms of people taking a step backwards and not cooperating with us, not working with us, not partnering with us, not reporting crimes, you know, looking at this order, it really caused me pause. It really kind of pushed me back when I first read it. So at this point, you know, I'm very concerned.
Mm. Final question. If you had a chance to speak to the president about this one-on-one, what would you say to him?
Great question. I would certainly ask him to reconsider a lot of the language in, as it pertains to the sanctuary city situation. Again, it means different things all over the country. Yeah. You know, looking at Chelsea in particular, and there's probably, in addition to Lawrence, there's probably many, many, many communities that do in fact cooperate with ICE, as we do. So to have this blanket provision in parentheses, sanctuary jurisdictions, and then allege that that means that they're in willful violation of federal law is not good. So I'd really like to sit down and if I could, or had the opportunity to talk to the president, to say there is a way, I think, for us to get together, get on the same page, but I don't think it's through this order.
All right. Well, that's Chelsea Police Chief Brian Kies. He's president of the Massachusetts Major City Chiefs of Police Association. Chief Kies, thanks so much for coming in today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And still ahead on the program, in the age of alternative facts, how the Springfield-based Merriam-Webster Dictionary is keeping up with the meaning of words. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary is trending, and among the reasons why is because of language like this from White House advisor Kellyanne Conway speaking last month on Meet the Press about the size of President Trump's inauguration crowd.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that.
Alternative facts. Now, after that statement about alternative facts, one of the most shared tweets on the topic came from Merriam-Webster's Twitter account, which offered the definition of fact, a piece of information presented as having objective reality. Merriam-Webster has seen spikes in searches on a number of words that dominate the news lately. To talk about how language is evolving, or maybe devolving, in the modern political age, we're joined from Springfield by Peter Sokolowski. He's already laughing at my introduction. Editor-at-large of Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Peter, good to have you. Thanks for joining us at Radio Boston.
It's great to be with you.
So, as a dictionary editor, how do you hear the words that are being used by politicians today differently than the rest of us might? What are you noticing?
I think you just said the word. The word is notice. A dictionary editor notices interesting usage. For example, to pick one at random, the use of the word deplorable as a noun. And what I mean by that is when you say basket of deplorables, that was an immediately sort of galvanizing statement in a political sense. But from a strictly linguistic standpoint, we only define the word deplorable as an adjective in our dictionary. And she said deplorables, making it a noun. And so immediately—
The she being Hillary Clinton, of course.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Hillary
ahead.
Clinton. And so not only was it a point of interest from a news perspective, it was a point of interest from a language perspective.
Right.
And we found very little evidence of the word used as a noun. It's an innovative use, and it shows the flexibility of language. So basically, it's not and it's an important point, I think, to your question. For lexicographers, it's not a question of judgment or correction. It's a question of noticing how the language is sort of twisted and bent, because that's the way language evolves.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a living, breathing thing. And just out of curiosity on that one example, is that enough for deplorable to move from adjective to adjective and noun in the Merriam-Webster dictionary?
Well, that's a very good question. That was clearly a very prominent use of the word by a prominent newsmaker. But actually, we look for a lot more than that. In other words, we would like to see sustained use, first of all. So that doesn't meet that criterion right there. We need to see that the word is used over a period of time. It has to have a widespread use, that is to say, by many people in many places, many publications. And it also doesn't meet that criterion. And finally, it has to have meaningful use, that is to say, has to have sort of an agreed upon discernible meaning to everyone who uses it, or most people who use it. And so far, that would basically be a word that we are watching for evolution, but it would have to be adopted by many others over a period of a few years before it got its own sort of home in the dictionary.
Well, Peter, give us some examples. For example, examples of words that have been added recently that speak especially to this moment that we're living in right now.
Sure. We just a week ago or so added 1,000 new words to our online dictionary, or more than 1,000 words, so, which is a big group of language information to bring in all at once. And it's true that some of them do kind of feel of the moment, but it's important to remember that those three criteria I just mentioned apply to all of these words, whether they're tech words or slang words or words for food or science terms. But, for example, net neutrality is in the news these days, and that is a noun that we just added to the dictionary. but also things that we do with technology, like binge watch or photobomb, or the kind of organization of technology, like abandonware and botnet. These were added to this last batch. Also, words from medical terms. We have, for example, elder care and super centenarian, that is to say, a person over 100 years of age. And that reflects clearly a piece of sort of medical innovation, which is to say that people are living longer.
Interesting. Now, Peter, you're able to track when people, when a word sort of shows up in the news, you're able to track people sort of searching for definitions, right?
Absolutely. In fact, that's the sort of surprise consequence of putting the dictionary online. We put the dictionary online in 1996, so a good long time ago now. And that was the first time for us that lexicographers could see what the public were curious about, what words are looked up. And initially, this was sort of a static list. They were kind of hard words or abstract words, words like affect and effect, which are so difficult in English, or integrity or paradigm or pragmatic, kind of abstract words that were always the SAT words. But then we saw in the first instance, one of the first news events that was widely shared online, which was the death of Princess Diana. And we saw the word paparazzi spike and the word cortege on the day of her funeral and the word princess itself. And so that told us that we can follow the news according to the vocabulary that sends people to the dictionary. And we have now about 100 million page views a month. So it's a large sample from which to register this this curiosity and to see what people look up and also what they don't look up.
It's interesting. I've got a very short list here that I want to ask you about. I understand the word vetting after the president signed his executive order on refugees. Suddenly a lot of people were searching for the word vetting, right?
Sure. And it makes sense. Because in this case, as frequently lately in political context, if a word has a broad general application, that's one thing. But when it's used in a very specific way, if it seems legal, if it seems technical, if it seems governmental, that can send people to the dictionary. And it's important to remember something. Curiosity is not ignorance. Most of us as adults look up words that we have encountered before. The words that people look up, one of the gratifying things we learned by putting the dictionary online is that the words that people look up tend not to be the sort of flashy new vocabulary that's brought in by the internet or by youth culture or by Hollywood movies. The words that people look up are the bread and butter words of ideas like ubiquitous and integrity and paradigm and conundrum. These are the words that people have slight trouble with the nuance, and they come to the dictionary for that nuance.
A few more words that I understand. You've seen spikes of lookups recently in response to political events. Impugn, after Mitch McConnell accused Elizabeth Warren of impugning Attorney General Jeff Senator Jeff Sessions on the Senate floor. Vetting, after the president, we talked about that one. Mm-hmm. Nepotism, after Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner was appointed to a senior role in the Trump administration.
Right. And I mean, these are very specific words. And, you know, it's interesting. You know, we're a dictionary. We talk about words, and this is what we, you know, we stick to the words. But with regard to impugn, for example, it's just interesting to look at the history of that word and recognize that its Latin root, pugnare, means to fight, which is the root of pugilism, boxing, or pugnacious, which means aggressive, right? And with nepotism, that comes from the Latin word for nephew, and it goes back to the idea that popes in the Renaissance would give the plum jobs to their own blood relatives. And so the fact is, our living language has a group of words, each of which has its own biography, doesn't it? And it has its own story. And that's the story that we like to tell, the story of these words.
Speaking of the story of words, I understand that fascism was one of your most search words in 2016.
Absolutely.
That's an interesting story.
Yeah, it is. And it has to, you know, you have to remember that it was also one of the most looked up words in 2015. As a consequence, you know, it's one of these words that is very near the top of our all-time lookup list. But I hasten to add that the word socialism is also up near the top of that list, as is the word democracy. And so it's, again, important to remember that curiosity is not ignorance. And curiosity also is not an accusation. People are curious about this word for many reasons. In the case of fascism, it's been in kind of the ether. It's been in political debates. It's been in social debates. But also, it's an intrinsically interesting word. It might be a little hard to pronounce. It's certainly hard to spell if you don't remember where that C goes after the S. Also has an intriguing history. You know, it comes from fasces, the bundles of wheat that were carried by the ancient Romans as symbols of military power, later adopted by Mussolini in Italy in the 1920s. And, of course, it's on the back of our dimes to this day. So the fact is it's a word that connects to the present through the past.
You know, I'm interested in knowing this. You've said that the goal of Merriam-Webster, and correct me if I'm wrong, is to tell the truth about what a word means. Is there? Do you get the sense, or is this just sort of a kind of perennial complaint by many people? But do you think people are now being more untruthful about what words mean, or using words more loosely, specifically in the political sphere, which is sort of where this conversation started? What do you think?
Sure. Well, there's certainly, you know, there's an intensity of interest at the moment about facts and truth. We know that because when the word fact spiked for several days, that was clearly the subject of the national conversation. And it's also a little bit unusual for us to see a word like that, a very common word, a word that's really used on a daily basis by most of us, to see that kind of intense interest, to look it up in the dictionary, to get the real specific linguistic facts about the word fact. Mm-hmm. So that does tell us something a little bit unusual is going on. Now, I'm not able to talk about the politics, really, but the fact is this is something that is often true in political debates. People are accusing each other of relative truthfulness. But it does seem to be that we're in a moment where people are seeking kind of objective truths and maybe researched and trustworthy sources. And to that extent, it's gratifying that people are turning to the dictionary because that's essentially what we've always done, isn't it?
It's really, really interesting. So let's end. I'm just going to ask you one more question is right where we started, and that is that wonderful moment when Kellyanne Conway used this term alternative facts, and then Merriam-Webster's Twitter account offered this definition, definition of fact, a piece of information presented as having objective reality. So understanding that definition, does the term alternative fact, I mean, can that possibly make sense given what we understand the word fact to mean?
It is an innovative use of language.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Peter Sokolow is editor-at-large of Merriam-Webster in Springfield, Massachusetts. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. What a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, a new children's book looks at the story of one prisoner's reentry through the eyes of his daughter. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's turn now to the Remembrance Project, our weekly look at the extraordinary lives of ordinary people from our community. Today, writer Alyssa Eli remembers a lifelong Rhode Islander who made a dream come true.
A few years after Archie Kenyon's wife died, he sold his house, bought a 48-foot sailboat, and named it after her. He was 76 years old. Over the next 13 years, he sailed the Betty Ann from Rhode Island to Florida each fall and from Florida to Rhode Island each spring. It was a second long and fulfilling marriage to a spouse with the same name. Ocean is a rough class of water. Archie took courses in diesel engine repair, hit the gym 5 days a week, studied fuel pumps and radar. He prepared for sea with the precision of a lawyer, which in fact he was, practicing up until right before his death. The Betty Ann was crewed by family and friends. Archie met them with fresh sheets and towels, Oreos and diet soda. He had the perfect captain's temperament, though not, his son Mike Kenyon remembers, a traditional captain's temperament.
When things went wrong, he stayed calm. He never yelled, and most folks who do a lot of sailing will tell you that most captains yell a lot. when his crew did something stupid, which was not uncommon, like plugging up the toilet with paper towels or hitting a buoy or other breaking things on the boat. He always acted like it was no big deal.
Archie was the best sailor on the boat by far, docking it with dexterity even into his late 80s. And he never felt seasick. Once he sailed for 36 hours in 13-foot waters and 35-knot seas off Cape Canaveral. His kids received a first cryptic email. Huge storm, really rough, cockpit blown out by a wave. Then they received a second.
You know, he wrote a long email describing the force of the storm, and it sounded pretty bad. But at the very end, his closing line was something like, it was fantastic.
For Archie, joy was in community.
Part of what we loved was you're typically sitting in the cabin. You're watching the horizon. There's the occasional dolphin sighting or sea turtle sighting. Everyone's very infrequently a whale. Submarine rising, which we saw several times, which was kind of extraordinary. And then there's also just the camaraderie and conversation. I know the crew that I typically sailed with, my friends and my dad, we would just talk and talk and talk and then would talk about it all again.
It was also in solitude.
Well, when he first bought the boat, we, his kids, asked him not to sail the boat on his own. And I can't say we ever got a firm commitment that he would not.
He was in Charleston, South Carolina.
And my sister, knowing that he was alone in Charleston waiting for the next crew, called him every day to ask how he was, what was up, how was Charleston. And every day he told her, Charleston's lovely. Only on Monday did we discover that for the last 3 days he had been sailing the boat alone down to Jacksonville, Florida.
Yet the rapscallion was utterly trustworthy. Even strangers felt it. One night, Archie and his crew docked in a small main harbor. The one restaurant in town was packed, and the hostess recommended a place 10 miles down the road.
And my dad said, oh, gee, we just sailed in on a boat. And she said, oh, no problem. Here are the keys to my car. It's parked over there. So we took the hostess's car and drove 10 miles up the road and had a great dinner.
Mike Kenyon talking to writer Alyssa Eli about his father, Archie Kenyon of Wakefield, Rhode Island, who died in December at the age of 89. If you want to suggest someone for a remembrance, send us an email to remember@wbur.org. When Megan Sullivan was 10 years old, her father was arrested and sent to prison. For 2 years, she had limited contact with him. And when he came home, things were different and difficult. Sullivan is an academic. She's associate dean for faculty development at Boston University and has done research on incarceration. But she wanted to write something that would allow her to share her own story and help children like her, whose parents are or have been incarcerated. She wrote the children's book Clarissa's Disappointment, with illustrations by Daniel Jay, a professor at Tufts University. The story follows a young girl, Clarissa, who waits 5 years for her much-loved father to come home from the Massachusetts House of Corrections. When he finally does, well, that's where the story becomes complicated, and we're going to talk about that now. And Megan Sullivan joins us to talk about her book, Clarissa's Disappointment, and welcome. It's good to have you. Good to meet you, Megan.
Welcome. Great to be here, Anthony.
So let's start talking about Clarissa's disappointment from the point of view of Clarissa, the protagonist. Tell us a bit about the story and what she's going through. Set it up for us.
Right. So Clarissa is from a very close family. She's an only child. And she and her mother go visit her father every month and have been doing so for the last 5 years. At the beginning of the story, the father is about to come home. And Clarissa is overjoyed. She can't wait wait for her father to come home because she doesn't know the reality, which is that it's very difficult for families when a loved one comes home from prison for various reasons. So the rest of the book kind of talks about her struggle and how in the process she becomes a writer.
And the struggle is multifaceted. I mean, obviously, for the father to reintegrate with society, to find a job, is a challenge, right?
Exactly.
He also has a drinking problem.
Right.
That's a problem.
Right.
And Clarissa finds that she is bullied at school around the fact that her father is a jailbird.
Exactly.
So these are some of the complications that she faces.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the book is inspired by a true story, your story, right?
Right, exactly.
So tell us a little bit about what you went through as a child.
Right. All of those things you just mentioned, we now know in the literature, happen to real children and real families. In my own case, I was luckier than a lot. I had 5 siblings, an incredibly devoted mother, and a father who made some mistakes. My father was what called a white-collar criminal. He was a lawyer. So we had a lot of advantages that a lot of kids didn't.
Yeah.
And yet, he was disbarred. So he could never practice law again. So when he came out of prison, he had to try to find a job in a whole new field. He had to come back to a town where it was widely known on the news, et cetera, what happened to him. So these are the kinds of things that I think my siblings and I were unaware of, and that I wanted to make it easier for other children.
Yeah, and when we talk about your disappointment or Clarissa's disappointment, I mean, the disappointment was that when you lose a parent and your parent goes away to prison, you're counting the years, the months, the days for that parent to return. And the sense I get from this wonderful book that you wrote is that it's such a simple idea. When daddy comes home, everything's going to be great again.
Exactly.
And then it doesn't turn out to be so great. So that's the disappointment.
Exactly.
What's the message here? Because among the other things that you offer in this book are support services for parents like this, right?
Exactly. So I think the message here is that we can be honest with children. We can tell them that things might not be easy when somebody comes home, that it might not just be all apple pie and smiley faces, and that we can give them the resources they need. My goal is that this book will be in every school library in the country, or as many as possible, because I feel like if a child just had a library book to tell them, you know, they could read a story that could make them say, wow, that character is going through what I'm going through. And then, by the way, because I have resources for teachers, families, and counselors, that counselors and teachers and family could read the book with children and help draw them out to talk about it or not talk about it or draw about it or whatever they want.
You've done research on incarceration. So, what's the universe of children how big is this universe of children that we're talking about that is affected by this situation?
Right now in the United States, we currently have 2.7 million minor children. It's usually children under the age of 10 who have one or more parents in prison. The vast majority of our prisoners will come home someday. They'll come back to their communities and many of them to their families. And so the process that we call the reentry period, when they come back into the community and their home, they really need help with that, as do their families.
Yeah. I'd love you to say a little bit more about the kind of disappointment that you experienced when your father came home. You said he had to look for a new career. What else happened? I mean, for example, what happened in your school environment to you?
My school environment was a private parochial school, so I didn't really have any trouble with other school children. And because I came from a big family, my siblings and I were all very close, so we were kind of a unified front that nobody would mess with.
Yeah.
But I think the disappointment came from the fact that, you know, in my case, for example, there was no money where there had been money before.
Sure.
That's a disappointment to a child when you have to do things or think about things that you never had to think about before. I also think that it's really hard to underestimate how children pick up on tension and stress in the family. And that, you know, you have a child who's going to school every day and maybe can't focus on that because there are minor or major tensions in the family. I think those are the kinds of disappointments. I think the main disappointment was that things aren't magically better. It's not like a movie. right. where everything's going to be better as soon as the homecoming.
Right. So in the story, Clarissa's disappointment, the stress at home actually leads to her dad leaving again and going to live with the grandparents, going to live with his parents.
Exactly.
And so that's a huge disappointment when she thought she was going to have her family all together. It ends up not being altogether. Did you experience that? Did your parents?
I did, actually.
They split apart.
They split apart after the fact, yeah. and that happens more often than we know. Of those families who are together, when somebody goes into prison, and not everybody is a united family. Mine was, and many families are, but then often it can't withstand.
Yeah.
You kind of all come together in the difficulty of incarceration, but then the day-to-day reality of afterwards can be difficult.
Megan Sullivan, you're white. You've written a story about Clarissa. The illustrations show her as non-white. Why did you make that decision?
That was a very conscious decision, and I talked to the publisher about it. I imagined Clarissa, the protagonist, is not me. She's based a little bit on my story, but she's not me. But I imagined her in my head. I imagined what she looked like, how she sounded, how she walked. I imagined everything about her. And I think partly that was informed by what I know statistically, which is the majority of incarcerated people in the United States are people of color, so that their children are people of color. And I couldn't imagine writing this book and then not allowing the majority of children who experience this to see themselves in the protagonist. So it was really important for me to do that. But it was also a struggle because I didn't want to be seen as appropriating anybody's ethnicity or race, and I also didn't want to be furthering any kind of stereotype, that is, that only children of color have parents in prison. Clearly, that's not the case, but statistically, they're more likely to deal with that.
Yeah. When Clarissa gets to school after her father comes back, there's a teacher. She has a teacher who shows her how to write a diary, Miss Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. Why is this important? What does the diary come to mean? How does it help her?
The diary is really important because it helps Clarissa talk about her feelings. She's an only child in the story, and she's also, as I say, from a close family, but not a family that talks about what's going on inside the home. So she needs an outlet. So she begins to write about her feelings. And then later, the diary morphs into a writer's notebook, which is different from a diary. It's not just her personal thoughts. It's the beginning that allows her to be a writer.
Yeah. Now, was this a detail that also came from your life? Did the diary help you?
Well, it's funny. I was never a diary keeper. So no, it really didn't. But I think that the experience of my father's incarceration, and I've written about this, I think that's what made me a writer. I think had I had what happened to him not happened, my life might have been very different. I certainly would have had a lot more privilege, and I'm not sure that I would have understood so well people from very different walks of life.
Clarissa and her family in this story end up going to a group called Families Together that helps people in this situation. Tell us about Families Together.
Right. Families Together is a figment of my imagination, but I'm very happy to say that there are more places like that today. There was no place like that when I was a child, and I doubt my family would have gone to that anyway. But there are places right now that work with children and families and then help them from everything from sometimes getting to the prison to visiting a loved one to communicating with people to giving legal advice and then to helping with the reentry process.
Right. And is part of that reminding kids or getting kids in contact with other kids who have incarcerated parents?
Exactly.
I have to imagine that that's an important part of it, right?
It is very important. And I think I'm especially interested in that because that wasn't what I had.
Yeah.
You know, my family, we didn't know anybody else who had ever been incarcerated. We didn't have children in our neighborhood who had that experience. So I think it's important for people to be able to talk about it.
Not a lot of people talk about this subject. And have you been able to share? I mean, this book is just coming out, but I'm interested what you're hearing from people and specifically this community of people.
This is very, it's funny, I'm getting great responses. And I also got really great responses from another book I published in March, which is an academic book on parental incarceration. So the experience has been great, but it took me I mean, I never spoke about this until about 10 years ago. My academic research was in a different area, partly because it's not necessarily the kind of thing people talk about. Yeah. It wasn't until I really started thinking about mass incarceration, and I started realizing that there were so many people and so many children affected by this, and that I had this background and the job that could help that, it almost seems selfish not to help that.
Mm. I'm sure I know the answer to this, but I'd love you to sort of express in what way a book like this would have helped you when you were young, when you were in this situation.
I think I was a reader. I was definitely a reader. My siblings and I were all readers. And imagine if we could have read a book that might have signaled to us that we weren't alone. Imagine if we had read a book that kind of hinted at the fact that life might not be rosy just as soon as a parent comes out of prison. I think it would have made me feel less alone, and I'm hoping it does that for other children. I also think the reason it had the resources for family, teachers, and counselors is because I'm hoping an adult talked to a child about this. There are still so many people with an incarcerated parent, and the family don't even tell the child. You know, because of the stigma.
Yeah, of course. Finally, I'd love to ask you this, Megan. What's your relationship with your father like now?
Well, my father actually died when I was in college.
I see.
But it was fairly typical of what happens. I don't actually think that prison necessarily helps people. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're more evolved or a better parent when they get out.
Yeah. Well, Megan Sullivan is the Associate Dean for Faculty Research and Development at Boston University. Her new book is Clarissa's Disappointment. It's about a young girl dealing with her father's return from prison after 5 years. Megan Sullivan, thanks so much for coming in. Great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Virginia Marshall and Caitlin O'Keefe. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.